If we really want to live, we'd better start at once to try. If we don't, it doesn't matter. But we'd better start to die. The choice is simple. Between now and the inevitable end of our days, we can choose either to live or to die. Biological life is an automatic process, as long as we take care of our needs of the body. But to live in the sense the poet means, it is by no means something that will happen by itself. If we don't take charge of its direction, our life will be controlled by the outside to serve the purpose of some other agency. Biologically programmed instincts will use it to replicate the genetic material we carry. The culture will make sure that we use it to propagate its values and institutions. Other people will try to make as much of our energy as possible to further their own agenda. All of this without regard to how any of this will affect us. We cannot expect anyone to help us live. We must discover how to do it by ourselves. There is no hope in the past. There is no solution to be found in the present. Nor will we be better off by jumping ahead into an imaginary future. The only path to finding out what life is about is a patient, slow attempt to make sense of the realities of the past and the possibilities of the future as they can be understood in the present. Life will mean what we experience from morning to night, 7 days a week. For about 70 years, if we're lucky. For even longer, if we are very fortunate. What this life will amount to is in part determined by the chemical processes in our body, by the biological interaction among organs, by the tiny electrical currents jumping between the synapses of the brain, and by the organization of information that the culture imposes on our mind. But the actual quality of life, what we do and how we feel about it, will be determined by our thoughts and emotions, by the interpretations we give to chemical, biological, and social processes. How can each person create an excellent life? If we look out of a window in winter, we might see millions of identical snowflakes cavorting by. But if we took a magnifying glass and looked at the flakes separately, we would soon discover that they were not identical. In fact, that each had a shape that no other flake duplicated exactly. The same is true of human beings. If everything was determined by the common human condition, by social and cultural categories and by chance, it would be useless to reflect on ways to make one's life excellent. Fortunately, there is enough room for personal initiative and choice to make a real difference. And those who believe this are the ones with the best chance to break free from the grip of fate. To live means to experience through doing, feeling, thinking. Experience takes place in time, so time is the ultimate scarce resource we have. Over the years, the content of experience will determine the quality of life. Therefore, one of the most essential decisions any of us can make is about how one's time is allocated or invested. Of course, how we invest time is not our decision alone to make. Nevertheless, there is room for personal choices, and control over time is to a certain extent in our hands. Even in the most oppressive decades of the Industrial Revolution, when workers slaved away for more than 80 hours a week in mines and factories, there were some who spent their few precious free hours in literary pursuits or political action instead of following the majority into the pubs. Rarely do we feel the serenity that comes when heart, will, and mind are on the same page. To control attention means to control experience, and therefore, the quality of life. How much stress we experience depends more on how well we control attention than on what happens to us. The effect of physical pain, of a monetary loss, depends on how much attention we pay to it, how much room we allow for it in consciousness. The more psychic energy we invest in a painful event, the more real it becomes, and the more entropy it introduces in consciousness. To deny, repress, or misinterpret such events is no solution either, because the information will keep smoldering in the recesses of the mind. It is better to look suffering straight in the eye, acknowledge and respect its presence, and then get busy as soon as possible, focusing on things we choose to focus on. All emotions share a basic duality, which is, they are either positive and attractive, or they are negative and repulsive. The evolution of self-reflective consciousness has allowed our race to toy with feelings, to fake or manipulate feelings in ways that no other animal can. The songs, dances, masks of our ancestors evoked dread and awe, joy and intoxication. Horror movies, drugs, and music do the same thing now. Everything we do is ultimately aimed at experiencing happiness. We don't really want wealth or health or fame as such. We want these things because we hope that they will make us happy. But happiness we seek not because it will get us something else, but for its own sake. In fact, if one wants to improve the quality of everyday life, happiness may be the wrong place to start. The quality of life does not depend on happiness alone, but also on what one does to be happy. If one fails to develop goals that give meaning to one's existence, if one does not use the mind to its fullest, then good feelings fulfill just a fraction of the potential we possess. Without dreams, without risks, only a trivial semblance of living can be achieved. Emotions refer to the internal states of consciousness. Negative emotions, like sadness, fear, anxiety, or boredom, produce psychic entropy in the mind. That is, a state in which we cannot use attention effectively to deal with external tasks, because we need it to restore an inner subjective order. Positive emotions, like happiness, strength, or alertness, are states of psychic negentropy, because we don't need attention to ruminate and feel sorry for ourselves, and psychic energy can flow freely into whatever thought or task we choose to invest it in. When we choose to invest attention in a given task, we say that we have formed an intention, or set a goal for ourselves. How long and how intensely we stick by our goal is a function of motivation. Intentions, goals, and motivations are also manifestations of psychic negentropy. They focus psychic energy, establish priorities, and thus create order in consciousness. Without them, mental processes become random, and feelings tend to deteriorate rapidly. It is the goals that we pursue that will shape and determine the kind of self that we are to become. The normal condition of the mind is one of informational disorder. Random thoughts chase one another instead of lining up in logical, causal sequences. Unless one learns to concentrate and is able to invest the effort, thoughts will scatter without reaching any conclusion. Usually, the more difficult a mental task, the harder it is to concentrate on it. But when a person likes what he does and is motivated to do it, focusing the mind becomes effortless, even when the objective difficulties are great. By learning to concentrate, a person acquires control over psychic energy, the basic fuel upon which all thinking depends. Imagine, for instance, that you are skiing down a slope and your full attention is focused on the movements of the body. There is no room in your awareness for conflicts or contradictions. You know that a distracting thought or emotion might get you buried face down in the snow. The run is so perfect that all you want is for it to last forever, to immerse yourself completely in the experience. If skiing does not mean much to you, substitute your favorite activity for this vignette. It could be singing in a choir, programming a computer, dancing, playing bridge, reading a good book. Or this complete immersion in the activity may occur in a social interaction, as when good friends talk with each other, or when a mother plays with her baby. What is common to such moments is that consciousness is full of experiences, and that these experiences are in harmony with each other. In moments such as these, what we feel, what we wish, and what we think are in harmony. The metaphor of flow is one that many people have used to describe the sense of effortless action they feel in moments that stand out as the best in their lives. Athletes refer to it as being in the zone, religious mystics as being in ecstasy, artists and musicians as aesthetic rapture. Athletes, mystics, and artists do very different things when they reach flow, yet their descriptions of the experience are remarkably similar. Flow tends to occur when a person faces a clear set of goals that require appropriate responses. It is easy to enter flow in games such as chess, tennis, or poker because they have goals and rules for action that make it possible for the player to act without questioning what should be done and how. For the duration of the game, the player lives in a self-contained universe where everything is black and white. The same clarity of goals is present if you perform a religious ritual, play a musical piece, write a computer program, climb a mountain, or perform surgery. Activities that induce flow could be called flow activities because they make it more likely for the experience to occur. In contrast to normal life, flow activities allow a person to focus on goals that are clear and compatible. Another characteristic of flow activities is that they provide immediate feedback. They make it clear how well you are doing. After each move of a game, you can tell whether you have improved your position or not. Flow tends to occur when a person's skills are fully involved in overcoming a challenge that is just about manageable. If challenges are too high, one gets frustrated, then worried, and eventually anxious. If challenges are too low relative to one's skills, one gets relaxed, then bored. If both challenges and skills are perceived to be low, one gets to feel apathetic. But when high challenges are matched with high skills, then the deep involvement that sets flow apart from ordinary life is likely to occur. A typical day is full of anxiety and boredom. Flow experiences provide the flashes of intense living against this dull background. When goals are clear and challenges and skills are in balance, attention becomes ordered and fully invested. Because of the total demand on psychic energy, a person in flow is completely focused. There is no space in consciousness for distracting thoughts or irrelevant feelings. Self-consciousness disappears, yet one feels stronger than usual. A sense of time is distorted, Hours seem to pass by in minutes. When a person's entire being is stretched into full functioning of body and mind, whatever one does becomes worth doing for its own sake. It is the full involvement of flow, rather than happiness, that makes for excellence in life. When we are in flow, we are not happy, because to experience happiness, we must focus on our inner states, and that would take away attention from the task at hand. If a rock climber takes time out to feel happy while negotiating a difficult move, he might fall to the bottom of the mountain. The surgeon cannot afford to feel happy during a demanding operation, or a musician playing a challenging score. Only after the task is completed do we have the leisure to look back on what has happened, and then we are flooded with gratitude for the excellence of that experience. But one can be happy without experiencing flow. We can be happy experiencing the passive pleasure of a rested body, a warm sunshine, or the contentment of a serene relationship. These are also moments to treasure, but this kind of happiness is very vulnerable and dependent on favorable external circumstances. The happiness that follows flow is of our own making, and it leads to increasing complexity and growth in consciousness. We can also see why flow leads to personal growth. In arousal, a person feels mentally focused, active, and involved, but not very strong, cheerful, or in control. How can one return to the more enjoyable flow state? The answer is obvious: by learning new skills. The flow experience acts as a magnet for learning, that is, for developing new levels of challenges and skills. It takes energy to achieve optimal experiences, and all too often, we are unable or unwilling to put out the initial effort. Flow is generally reported when a person is doing his or her favorite activity. A life filled with complex flow activities is more worth living than one spent consuming passive entertainment. To be totally absorbed in what you are doing, and to enjoy it so much that you don't want to be doing anything else? I don't see how people survive if they don't experience something like that. When we are able to confront life with such involvement and enthusiasm, we can be said to have achieved an autotelic personality. Autotelic is a word composed of two Greek roots, auto, meaning self, and telos, meaning goal. An autotelic activity is one we do for its own sake because to experience it is the main goal. An autotelic person needs few material possessions and little entertainment, comfort, power, or fame because so much of what he or she does is already rewarding. Because such persons experience a flow in work, in family life, when interacting with people, when eating, and even when alone with nothing to do, they are less dependent on the external rewards that keep others motivated to go on with a life composed of dull and meaningless routines. They are more autonomous and independent because they cannot be as easily manipulated with threats or rewards from the outside. At the same time, they are more involved with everything around them because they are fully immersed in the current of life. If there is one quality that distinguishes autotelic individuals, it is that their psychic energy seems inexhaustible. Even though they have no greater attentional capacity than anyone else, they pay more attention to what happens around them, they notice more, and they are willing to invest more attention in things for their own sake, without expecting an immediate return. Most of us hoard attention carefully. We dole it out only for serious things, for things that matter. We only get interested in whatever will promote our welfare. The objects most worthy of our psychic energy are ourselves and the people and things that will give us some material or emotional advantage. The result is that we don't have much attention left over to participate in the world on its own terms. To be surprised, to learn new things, to empathize, or to grow beyond the limits set by our self-centeredness. Autotelic persons are less concerned with themselves, and therefore have more free psychic energy to experience life with. If one has failed to develop curiosity and interest in the early years, it is a good idea to acquire them now, before it is too late to improve the quality of life. Many people will say that this advice is useless to them, because they already have so many demands on their time that they absolutely cannot afford to do anything new or interesting. Time stress has become one of the most popular complaints of the day. But more often than not, it is an excuse for not taking control of our lives. How many of the things that we do are really necessary? How many of the demands could be reduced if we put some energy into prioritizing, organizing, and streamlining the routines that now fritter away our attention? It is true that if we let time run through our fingers, we will soon have none left. Not so much in order to achieve wealth and security in some distant future, but in order to enjoy life in the here and now. Time is what one must find in order to develop interest and curiosity to enjoy life for its own sake. The other equally important resource is the ability to control psychic energy. Instead of waiting for an external stimulus or challenge to grab our attention, we must learn to concentrate it more or less at will. If you are interested in something, you will focus on it. And if you focus attention on anything, it is likely that you will become interested in it. Work has severe drawbacks, but its lack is worse. It is possible to learn to like solitude, but it does not come easily. If one is an artist, scientist, or writer, or if one has a hobby or a rich inner life, then being alone is not only enjoyable but necessary. Relatively few individuals, however, master the mental tools that will make this possible. Whether we like solitude or not, however, in our times we must be able to put up with some of it. It's difficult to learn math or practice piano or program a computer or figure out the purpose of one's life when other people are around. The concentration required to order thoughts in consciousness is easily interrupted by an extraneous word, by the necessity to pay attention to another person. As long as we can presume that the others will share our basic goals and will behave predictably within certain limits, their presence adds a great deal of spice to the quality of life. Romance and sex provide some of the best moments of the day, but for most people these activities are rather rare, so they fail to make much of a difference in the overall quality of life unless they are embedded in a context of an enduring relationship that provides emotional and intellectual rewards as well. Variety and frequency of sexual encounters have taken precedence over the depth and intensity of the relationship in which they are embedded. A force that could result in some of the deepest and most intimate joys of life is taken over and manipulated by outside interests. As with other aspects of life, the important thing is to decide for oneself, to realize what is at stake, and what are the interests that try to control our sexuality for their own ends. It helps to realize how vulnerable we are in this respect. It is a very universal condition. What counts is how we wish to order our lives and what part we wish sexuality to play in it. And the less we depend on it for material benefits, the more we can enjoy its potential for emotional rewards. The effects of family relationships on the quality of life are so extensive that volumes could be written about it. The only way to take over the ownership of life is by learning to direct psychic energy in line with our own intentions. The quality of life is much improved if we learn to love what we have to do. The problem is that people also learn to love things that are destructive to themselves and to others. Enjoying what one does is not sufficient reason for doing it. Flow is a source of psychic energy in that it focuses attention and motivates action. Like other forms of energy, it is neutral. It can be used for constructive or destructive purposes. Fire can be used to warm us up on a cold night, or it can be used to burn down the house. The same is true of electricity or nuclear energy. Thus, in creating a good life, it is not enough to strive for enjoyable goals, but also to choose goals that will reduce the sum total of entropy in the world. These goals cannot be justified only in terms of our lives here and now, because if the only effects of our actions were the ones we could observe in this life, common sense would dictate that we get as much pleasure and material advantage as we can, even if we must be ruthless in the process. There are enough hints about how the universe functions to know that what kind of actions support the increase of complexity and order, and what kind lead toward destruction. In order to experience flow, it helps to have clear goals. Not because it is achieving the goals that is necessarily important, but because without a goal, it is difficult to concentrate and avoid distractions. The simple way of improving the quality of life is to take ownership of one's actions. The same ability to transform a tragic situation into at least a tolerable one is shown by victims of terrorists who survive solitary confinement or prisons and concentration camps. Those who survive are able to ignore selectively the external conditions and to redirect their attention to an inner life that is real only to themselves. It is easier to do so if you know poetry, mathematics, or some other system of symbols that allows you to concentrate and do mental work without any visible material props. These examples suggest what one needs to learn to control attention. In principle, any skill or discipline one can master on one's own will serve. Meditation and prayer, if one is so inclined. Exercise, aerobics, martial arts, for those who prefer concentrating on physical skills. Any specialization or expertise that one finds enjoyable and where one can improve one's knowledge over time. The important thing, however, is the attitude toward these disciplines. If one prays in order to be holy, or exercises to develop strong pectoral muscles, or learns to be knowledgeable, then a great deal of the benefit is lost. The important thing is to enjoy the activity for its own sake, and to know that what matters is not the result, but the control one is acquiring over one's attention. Normally, attention is directed by genetic instructions, social conventions, and habits we learned as children. Most of what we experience will have been programmed for us. We learn what is supposed to be worth living and dying for. Through the years, our experience will follow the script written by biology and culture. The accident of birth puts a person in a slot that greatly determines what sorts of experiences his or her life will consist of. Unfortunately, there is no justice, nor any rhyme or reason in one person being born into a starving community, perhaps even with a congenital physical defect, while another starts life with good looks, good health, and a large bank account. So while the main parameters of life are fixed, and no person can avoid resting, eating, interacting, and doing at least some work, humanity is divided into social categories that determine to a large extent the specific content of experience. When and where we happen to be born defines a single coordinate of existence that no one else shares. Thus, each of us is responsible for one particular point in space and time in which our body and mind forms a link within the total network of existence. For, whereas it is true that Who we are is determined by genetic instructions and social interactions. It is also true that having invented the concept of freedom, we can make choices that will determine the future shape of the network of which we are a part. Whether we like it or not, our lives will leave a mark on the universe. One cannot lead a life that is truly excellent without feeling that one belongs to something greater and more permanent than oneself. It would be so much easier if we were responsible only for ourselves. Unfortunately, things don't work that way. An active responsibility for the rest of humankind and for the world of which we are a part is a necessary ingredient of a good life. The real challenge, however, is to reduce entropy in one's surroundings without increasing it in one's consciousness. Act always as if the future of the universe depended on what you did, while laughing at yourself for thinking that whatever you do makes any difference. It is this serious playfulness that makes it possible to be both engaged and carefree at the same time. Helping to maintain order in the universe becomes its own reward, regardless of consequences. Then it is possible to find joy even when fighting a losing battle in a good cause. The danger is that one's entire psychic energy will go towards satisfying the needs of the imaginary entity we have ourselves created. This might not be too bad if the self we bring into being is a reasonable entity. But children who are abused may grow up constructing a hopeless or vindictive image of self. Children who are indulged without being loved may create narcissistic selves. A self may grow to be insatiable or have a completely exaggerated idea of its importance. Persons who own such a distorted self nevertheless feel compelled to satisfy its needs. If they think they need more power, or money, or love, or adventure, they will do everything to satisfy that need, even beyond what is good for them in the long run. In such cases, a person's psychic energy, directed by an ill-conceived ego, is likely to cause entropy in the environment, as well as within consciousness. For each of us, the chief obstacle to a good life is oneself. Yet if we learn to live with it, the self can become a friend, a helper, a rock upon which to build a fulfilling life. We all have the opportunity to use ambition, the need to be loved, even aggressiveness, in constructive ways, without being carried away by them. Once we realize what our demons are, we need not fear them any longer. Instead of taking them seriously, we can smile with compassion at the arrogance of these fruits of our imagination. We don't have to feed their ravenous hunger except on our own terms, when to do so helps us achieve something worthwhile. What we feel, what we wish, and what we think are in harmony.